जय डिवाइन कृष्ण प्रभुपाद की जय। श्री श्री राधा गोपीनाथ ललिता देवी विशाखा देवी की जय। श्री श्री ग्रंथराज श्रीमद् भागवतम की जय। निताय गौर प्रेमानंदी हरि हरि बोल। Hare Krishna. So first of all, I want to begin by expressing my appreciation for the devotees here. I've just come from a week at Govardhan Eco Village, and now just in transit onward in India. And I'm always overcome by a lot of surprise and admiration to see the wonderful qualities of the brahmacharis here in Chaupati and Govardhan Eco Village. It's really the amount of qualification you have materially combined with the humility that comes from devotional practice and the learning of shastras is really an amazing, amazing package. If for me, each one of you is very much worshipable as a result of this quality. I mean, there at Govardhan Eco Village and here also today, seeing someone who's, I think pretty much all of you are technically qualified in engineering or some other technical subject, and probably B-Tech or M-Tech or even more, and standing there on the altar and adjusting Krishna's cloth just like this and the garland just, who would have thought that an engineer is even capable of such artistic, beautiful decoration? But it's amazing how in Srila Prabhupada's movement we all discover skills that we never thought we had. Some are beautiful singers and some are wonderful cooks and some are excellent at decorating the deity. Whereas in the material world everything is so monotone. You know, everyone has to be in a particular track. Everyone has to be an engineer. Everyone has to be a doctor. Otherwise there's no success. But in spiritual and Krishna consciousness, everything is so dynamic and so unique that every person has a unique skill and a capacity. So I just wanted to start by offering my respects to all the devotees here. You're all very worshipable for persons like myself. So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, as always, Canto 11. This is called Description of Mystic Yoga Perfections. It's continuing with Krishna's instructions to Uddhav, chapter 15, text number 24 is the text. So please repeat. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Parshnya Pidya Gudam Pranam. Parshnya Pidya Gudam Pranam. Hridura Kantha Murdhasu. Hridura Kantha Murdhasu. Aropya Brahma Randhrena. Aropya Brahma Randhrena. Brahmani Tvotsrijetanum. Brahmani Tvotsrijetanum. Parshnya Pidya Gudam Pranam. Hridura Kantha Murdhasu. Aropya Brahma Randhrena. Brahmani Tvotsrijetanum. Parshnya Pidya Gudam Pranam. Hridura Kantha Murdhasu. ಆರೋಪ್ಯ ಬ್ರಹ್ಮರಂಧ್ರೇಣ ಬ್ರಹ್ಮನೀತ್ವೋತ್ಸೃಜೇತನು ಪಾರ್ಷ್ಣ್ಯಾಪೀಡ್ಯ ಗುದಂ ಪ್ರಾಣಂ ಹೃದುರಾಕಂಠಮೂರ್ಧಸು ಆರೋಪ್ಯ ಬ್ರಹ್ಮರಂಧ್ರೇಣ ಬ್ರಹ್ಮನೀತ್ವೋತ್ಸೃಜೇತನು ಪೀಡ್ಯಾಗುದಂ ಪ್ರಾಣಂ ladies. Arshya pidya gudam pranam murdhasu aropya brahma randhena amani potra jetanum parshnya with the heel of the foot. Apidya, blocking. Gudam, the anus. Pranam, the vital air carrying the living entity. Hrit, from the heart. Ura, to the chest. Kantha, to the neck. Murdhasu, and to the head. Aropya, placing. Brahmarandhrena, by the spiritual seat at the top of the head. Brahma, to the spiritual world, or impersonal Brahman, or any other destination one has selected. Nitva, leading the soul. Utsrajet, one should give up. Tanum, the material body. Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The yogi who has achieved the mystic perfection called Swachanda Mrityu blocks the anus with the heel of the foot and then lifts the soul from the heart to the chest, to the neck, and finally to the head. Situated within the Brahmarandhra, the yogi then gives up his material body and guides the spirit soul to the selected destination. Purport. This mystic opulence of Swachanda Mrityu, or dying at will, was wonderfully exhibited by Bhishmadev at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, the term Brahma, as used in this verse, is an example of Upalakshana, or the use of a general term to indicate various concepts. Brahma here indicates the particular destination selected by the yogi, namely the spiritual sky, the impersonal Brahma Jyoti, or any other destination that has attracted the yogi's mind. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk here for some time about death. Now, this is a very interesting verse because The ability to die is being called a yogic siddhi. So normally when we think of yogic siddhis, then we think of ways in which to live and ways in which to enjoy life in this world. And most of the siddhis have something to do with that. Gaining this or gaining that, bringing this here, enjoying in the gardens of heaven. But here, the ability to die at will, when we like, swachanda mrityu, is regarded as one of the great yogic siddhis. The question that naturally arises is, why would one want to die to begin with? And dying at will, what does that actually mean? Because we live in a world where no one dies at will, right? Everyone dies because they're forced to. You extend the course of your life longer and longer and longer and longer until you cannot extend it anymore, and then you die. So the fact that someone would want to die is a very confusing idea for the average person in this world. And yet for a yogi, it's a very attractive prospect. Why? So let's think about death just a little bit, okay? Now, talking about death is something that's generally considered in our Indian culture to be a very inauspicious thing to do. If you ever say, you know, like my spiritual master, Hanumat Preshaka Swami, he's very fond of saying often that when we say, Maharaj, we look forward to seeing you again soon. And he'll often say, well, that's if we live, right? We may die tomorrow, who knows? And if you say something like this, especially as you're getting ready to leave, then in India everyone say, hai, hai, kya bol diya, aise mat bolo, don't speak like that. Because if you say something about death, the idea is maybe death will hear and come. So we'll attract death. It's very inauspicious. Or if someone goes around saying, Ram Naam Satya Hai, everyone says, hey, abhi kyun bol, aise mat bolo. Don't speak like that, right? Because this is our idea that death is something to be afraid of, to be worried about. But in the context of spiritual life, it's exactly the opposite, right? It's exactly the opposite. In Hitopadesha, at the beginning, it says that in matters of learning, one should think that we will live forever. Why? Because the amount of knowledge in this world is so vast that if you think I have limited time, you'll be so frustrated and so disappointed. How will I get through the entire Bhagavatam plus Chaitanya Charitamrita plus Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu plus the Shat Sandarbhas? It's too much, right? So let's think we're going to live forever. But in matters of spiritual life, Hitopadesha says, one should think that one is already within the jaws of death, that the jaws of death already have us by the neck, and it's only a matter of time before they close. This will create urgency in us. So the great philosopher Socrates, he died because he was sentenced to death. He was accused. This is in ancient Greece, thousands of years ago. He was accused of corrupting the youth, corrupting the young, because he was a man of knowledge. Prabhupada called him Brahman realized. He was Brahmabhuta on that level, definitely. People didn't want to hear, like today. No one wants to hear about such knowledge, especially not for the young people. And so he was accused of corrupting the young, sentenced to death, and given poison to drink, this hemlock poison, in prison. So all his disciples and his followers were there, and they all told him, you know, Socrates, we can help you escape from this prison house. It's not a problem. Just let us know. We have enough contacts. I mean, he was a very famous person. And we take you to some small island in the Greek, in the Mediterranean Sea, and you can live your life in peace there, enjoying nice figs to eat and good olive oil and nice sunshine. You don't have to die. Please come. We'll help you. And Socrates' answer, you know what it was? He said, no, this is a good opportunity to die. Normally, it's not considered to be a good thing, right, in any religion of the world to commit suicide. It's considered to be a great sin. So any person will not do that, any person who is reasonable. But here, I've been sentenced to die by my higher authorities. They've told me to do this. So let me follow their instructions and get out of this world. Take the opportunity to exit the train when I can. Because anyway, the material world is a miserable place. So everyone was shocked at his attitude towards death like this. Why are you saying this? And he said, look, death is only frightening because we don't know what is on the other side. If you know where you're going, if you know what's happening, then there's nothing to be afraid of. It's just like if you're on a train and then you know the final stop is coming, you have to get off the train. So if you're getting off in and you don't know what city I'm in, is this Mumbai, is it Delhi, is it, you don't know. And you don't know anyone in the city who's going to receive me, where do I go, and it's the middle of the night and you can't see anything, of course you're going to be afraid. But if you're getting off the train and you know my family is here to receive me, and they're going to have a vehicle ready, and I'm going to my home, then is there any fear to get off the train? Of course not. You look forward to it. Finally, the long journey is over, we get to get off. So, Socrates' attitude towards death was like that. He said, I have nothing to be afraid of because I know, he said, I know what's coming on the other side. So why am I afraid? There's another conversation that Socrates has during his lifetime where he and his disciples are debating, how do you know that a man is actually happy? How do you know that a person is happy? And someone suggests, oh, if he has great wealth. But of course, that wealth is not a source of happiness and it could be lost very soon. If he has all of these things or those things, if he has great wisdom or knowledge, and they go through one possibility after another, rejecting each one, until finally the decision is that we cannot know whether a person is happy or not until we have seen how they die. How they die. Because even the so-called happy person, all their life, at the end of their life, they can suffer a horrible, miserable death. We know many such examples, right? I have heard that even people like Saddam Hussein, who was a great dictator and, you know, ran lots of, so much money and everything, so powerful. When they finally found him, he was in underground little bunker in his house and he was shivering and begging, please don't shoot me, please don't kill me. Right? Even great people, when it comes to the time of death, they become frightened, trembling, begging, crying, passing stool and urine. What is the use of such a life? How can you know that that person is actually happy? Bhagavatam says exactly the same thing as Socrates. Etavan sankhya yoga abhyam swadharma parinishthaya janmalabha parapumsam ante narayana smriti. That really, if you want to know what is success, what is labha for a human being, what is real gain, forget the material wealth that we've already rejected. But sankhya, yoga, swadharma, doing one's own duty, all of those things, the whole point is ante narayana smriti. It's the quality of our death that marks the greatness of a person's life. There's another philosopher, I forget his name, I think it was Nietzsche, who said that the only reason human beings are driven to do anything in this world, whether it's philosophical reflection or the collection of money or wealth or production of art and literature and culture, the only reason human beings are driven to do anything in this world is why? Because we know death is coming. Because we know our time is limited in this world. And that's what motivates us. Imagine if our life was endless in this world. If it had no end. Would we be driven to do anything? Would you push your children to get an education? No. You know, aaj school nahi jana hai to kal jana. What's the rush, right? Would we be driven to chant our rounds, go back to Godhead? Aaj mala nahi hui to kal. You have unlimited amounts of time, right? The fundamental motivation in this world is the limitation of time. The limitation of time. Years ago, I read this article that someone had invented this life clock. The life clock was basically is if you put in your age, your gender, and whether you smoke and you don't smoke, a few major factors, it would give your average remaining lifespan in years, months, days, minutes, and seconds. This is how much time you have. And then it would start a countdown. Can you imagine? Unfortunately, the invention did not sell very well at all. It was mostly a flop. Because who would want to actually live thinking in this world, thinking of the time, limited time they have until death? So the measure of a person's life, right? The measure of a person's life is the quality of our death. And the reason we are motivated to do anything in this world is because our time is very limited, right? This is why we do what we do. The spiritual world is a very different place. But here in this world, death is our primary motivating factor for anything. And therefore, the contemplation of death is a great virtue, is a great practice in every religious tradition of the world. A couple years ago, I was in Kiev in Ukraine. And after lectures and stuff like that, the devotees arranged a little tour. And we went to this Christian monastery, where one of the largest Christian monasteries, where the monks, these brahmacharis, sannyasis, they have lived for thousands of years. And one of the largest in Europe. And a big portion of the monastery was underground caves. They had dug out caves. And any time someone would die, they would bury the person underground, but leave the bones, the skulls, visible, showing. And then every once in a while, these monks, they would go down in the cave and sit and meditate in front of these skulls, facing it. Now the tourists can go in. You see everyone's faces. Just to drive home this point, that life is temporary, that death is something that we have to prepare for. So, with that prologue, let's think of death for a minute in several different ways. Okay? First of all, death from the perspective of the person in this world, the materialist. Death is something to be feared, basically. Death is a cause of anxiety and worry. It's the great destroyer of this world, like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Mrityu sarva harashchaham. I take everything away. And so the world spends its time basically trying to avoid death. Right? This is the motivation behind everything we do, from locking our doors at night to getting insurance plans to anything we do. The motivation, the cosmetics we put on our body, everything is to avoid or delay death or the precursors to death, namely old age. In fact, this death is for the average person is basically a cause for fear and something to avoid. There was the great scientist Robert Oppenheimer. Maybe you've heard his name. He's the one who invented the atomic bomb. 1945 in New Mexico in the United States in the Los Alamos laboratories. They did the Trinity test. This was the test of the first explosion of the atomic bomb in the desert. And when the atomic bomb exploded, Mangalarti time, July 16th, 1945, they exploded and they had all kinds of instruments to measure the explosion. And the mushroom cloud, the famous picture we've seen, the mushroom cloud coming up like this and blanketing everyone, and the great ball of fire and lightning. He said for a few moments, night became day, right? It was still dark outside. It became completely as bright as daylight. And every instrument that they had used, they had set up to measure the power of the bomb, was melted. It was completely destroyed. No one could actually measure. At that moment, Robert Oppenheimer thought of the Bhagavad Gita. And you know which verse he remembered from Gita? Kalosmi sarvakshaya krit pravidho. Two verses he remembered. That one, Kalosmi. Time I am, the great destroyer of these worlds. Or death I am. That's how he translated, because Kal means also death. Death I am, the great destroyer of these worlds. And then the second verse he remembered was also from chapter 11. If 10,000 suns were to rise in the sky at the same time, that would be the brilliance of this universal form. That was Sanjay's statement, trying to explain to Dhritarashtra how brilliant this was. That is the nature of death for the average person. Actually, Robert Oppenheimer was a great lover of Bhagavad Gita. He went to University of California, Berkeley, to study Sanskrit just so he could learn Bhagavad Gita, just so he could read Gita in the original. And on his bookshelf, he used to always keep a little pink bound copy of Bhagavad Gita on his shelf anytime, so he could refer to it as he was doing his research. So much he loved Gita that and Krishna as a result, that he named his car Garuda also. So Gita has been loved by so many people. But this is what death means for the average person. Something to be ayur harati vaipum sam udyan astan chayanaso. Something that is killing us gradually. For the yogi, who's far more advanced than the average karmi, death is something more beneficial. It's something not to be feared. It's something very useful. Death becomes a tool. It becomes a tool. For the karmi, death is an axe. It's a weapon. Something to be feared. But for the yogi, it's still a tool, but something very useful, not something to be feared. It's an instrument. Why? Because it's a tool using which they can enter into any place they want to. They can choose their destination, they can choose the time and the moment of their departure. And because, like Socrates, they do not fear death, they know where they are going. Therefore, it's just like us planning where to get off from the train. It's just like if I want to take a flight, then I know I need to get to the airport at this time, check in by this time, and be on board the flight 45 minutes or 15 minutes before departure. I know the whole schedule. For a yogi, it's like the same way. The yogi thinks, if I need to take this flight, I want to drink somaras, and I need to go to the moon planet, I need to be preparing in samadhi by this time, so that I can leave my body by this time, so I can travel on the pathways of the wind, through these pranic pathways, to the heavenly planets by this time. And at the door, the gate for boarding will be open for me. That's all. That's all he thinks. Okay, there may be a little bit of distress, just like you go to the airport or the station. Then it's a little bit of distress. You say goodbye to people you love and say, we'll see you soon again. But it's not a major, you know, thing. You just say, we'll come back, we'll see you. Just like with Dadichi Muni, right? Indra asks him for his bones. And initially Dadichi Muni teases him and says, no, I won't give you. But eventually he's like, yeah, take my bones, take my body. Another one is coming. And I know where to go, I know where to find another one. It's like giving your jacket to someone. Right? You're feeling cold, take the jacket. If you don't get it, you think, okay, maybe I'll get it back. Some attachment may be there. If you don't get it back, it's okay. There's more jackets available in this world. It's not a big deal for people like that. Right? Dadichi Muni just is happy to give away his body. It's not a problem. All these great yogis, they know exactly where they're going, when they're going. Their bodies are just tools to get there. They're vehicles. And they abandon one vehicle to enter another vehicle because they know what the scheduling is like. We board a car to get to the airport. We get off the car. We abandon our car. We get on the plane. We abandon the plane. We get in another vehicle. We know. We abandon one vehicle after another. The vehicles are just tools to get to where they want to go. Even, not just for yogis, even for advanced kshatriyas, this is the same approach to death. right? Swargadvaram apavritam, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. That the doors to Swarga are open. It's just like that, like a boarding gate. You get out, you know what gate to get into. If I fight in this battle and I die. So it's a little less predictable than the yogis, but you know, more or less, right? Everyone knows. You know, your wife knows, your children know. He's going every month to fight in some battle. One day he will not come back. That is painful, no doubt, but everyone knows. He's entered another gate. Death is just a tool to be used for your further benefit. So for the karmi, death is an axe to be feared. It's going to kill. You avoid it. For the yogi, death is a tool to be used for your own benefit. And for the bhakta, death is neither an axe nor a tool, but it's an invitation. It's an invitation. It's like you get marriage invitations, right? Someone who you have a relationship with is giving you personally an invitation. In India, we have a nice culture of giving invitations. Months before the marriage, you go to people's homes and you say, "Aap aiyega." And it's coming from someone you love. If you're really close to that person, they won't mail the invitation. They'll come to your house with it. Say, "You must come." If they're a little distant, they'll mail it with a personal note. Little more distant, they'll just mail it. Even more distant, they'll just email it to you. Come. But if the relationship is personal, they'll come personally and say, "Please come." And that kind of invitation, you know from someone who is affectionate to you. This is someone they're saying, "Please join me for the most important moment of my adult life. Come." That's something different, right? And when we receive an invitation like that, so for a devotee, a death is an invitation. A devotee thinks this death is that invitation card I've received from Krishna. Come. Your time in this world is over. You're welcome back home. Come to your reward. And so for a bhakta, this is and something to look forward to. Something to embrace. Something worth meditating upon. Now we see for why in this world thinking of death is so inauspicious. But for the bhakta, thinking of death is such an auspicious thing. Because what could be more auspicious than the door that opens up for us to go back home, back to Godhead? And we see the finest example of this in the case of Dhruva Maharaj, one of the most beautiful descriptions in Srimad Bhagavatam. When he's one fine day, he sees this Vimana coming from the sky, and the Vishnu Dutas are there, all beautifully decorated. They come to him with folded hands and they say, "The Lord Himself has sent us to you. He has deputed us to bring you with all honor back to Vaikuntha." This is an invitation, right? It's a nimantrana from the Lord to please come. And Dhruva Maharaj is, it's Bhagavatam says that he's not, he's so surprised and overwhelmed by the Vishnu Dutta's arrival that he's at a loss for words. He doesn't know what to say. This is my experience being around Radhanath Maharaj. He receives you with so much affection and he looks so deeply into your eyes with a full heart that all words disappear. You don't know what to say. And this is a big deal, especially for a professor. You know, we're always good with words. this is our job. Is we're juggling words. And yet, when that kind of invitation comes, right, something from the heart, you don't know what to say. Dhruva Maharaj, he didn't know what to say. I mean, Krishna has sent the Vishnu Dutas in a special airplane just for me. So what does he do? Bhagavatam says he just offers his obeisances. He just bows down. And this is a beautiful principle for us as devotees, that when there are those moments that are too overwhelming, too grand for us to handle, because such moments come in a devotee's life. You see, Krishna, we serve the greatest master. We serve the Supreme Lord. Krishna is such a wonderful person, such a wonderful master. He's so generous at our heart, so generous in giving us, that when Krishna reciprocates with a devotee, we don't know how to handle it. We don't know how to respond in that situation. I think all of you must have had this experience, right? That those moments in life where we do our little service for Krishna every day. We try to do our best. We fail sometimes. We try to do better. We try to put our heart into what we do. We struggle. Sometimes we're good. Sometimes we're not. But over the course of time, we do it every day, every day, every day. And then someday, for no particular reason, Krishna will reciprocate in some way. Through his devotees, through Bhagavatam, through the deities, we'll feel some connection. Krishna has reciprocated in some way. But when Krishna reciprocates, he doesn't reciprocate in proportion. Actually, when he says, ye yatha mam prapadyante, he's actually lying in the case of a devotee. He doesn't reciprocate tit for tat. When he gives, as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, right? He gives with 10 hands. How much will you hold with your 2 hands? It becomes overwhelming for a devotee. It becomes too much for us to handle. We can't figure out, how do I receive such mercy? And then at that point, the best thing to do is simply pay our obeisances to the Lord, to bow down and say, Krishna, you've defeated me. And you've defeated me. I thought I understood you. I thought I knew what I was getting into. And just like when Narada Muni, right, for that one moment, he has Krishna's darshan in his heart, in his first life, in his previous life. He sees Krishna for one moment. He doesn't know what to say. He doesn't know what to do. We cannot predict when Krishna's mercy will arrive, right? Dhruva Maharaj was taken aback by the Lord's response. He didn't know when it was going to come. Narada Muni was taken aback. He didn't expect it. We don't know when Krishna will reciprocate. Sometimes we try to grab mercy, right? We try to arrange mercy in our life. If I go to this kirtan, I'll feel some real intense mercy. I have had this experience, going to some big kirtan mela or something. And you're sitting there and like mind is here and you're like, you could be anywhere, right? And no feeling is there. Nothing is coming. And then one day you'll be in the temple and just 2 people at noon arti, no one is there. And like all this mercy is flowing. You don't know why. You don't know why. It's no big deal. You didn't arrange anything. When we try to arrange everything for Krishna's mercy to come, put this in place, get this person, I want to try here and like that, use this method. And Krishna tells Narada Muni, no, bhakti is not a mechanical process. I reciprocate when I want to, when I want to. And when that moment happens, then it's so overwhelming that all a devotee can do is namamyaham, can just offer obeisances. That's it, nothing more. And that's what Dhruva Maharaj did. When Krishna sent the Vishnu Dutas, he was so overwhelmed by the Lord's mercy. For me, he's sending up an airplane from Vaikuntha and 2 of his associates just to take me. He doesn't know what to say. So he offers his obeisances. And they say, then they speak, the Vishnu Dutas, and they say, please come to the Lord's abode. You have pleased him so much. This is your reward. Come to that place from which one never returns. They invite him so generously and so culturally, in such a nice cultured way. Please board this airplane. And just as he's getting ready to board, then, Antakam Agatam, Bhagavatam says. Antaka, that is death personified, Mrityu, comes at that time, approaches. Prabhupada translates, he approaches very slowly. And when some great person comes to some place and some formalities need to be filled out, some forms or something like that, then the person, formalities have to be done, right? So they'll say, please, aap yahan ek sign kar dena yahan pe. So death is like that. He's saying, it's a formality in this world. I have to do my seva. I'm death. I have to, I'm part of this moment also. Can you please sign here? And so Prabhupada says he approaches, not he comes with an axe, He approaches. Antakam agatam. And Dhruva Maharaj, in his humility, he accepts. Mrityor murdhni. He says, on the head of Mrityu, he steps. He uses him, he accepts him as a stepping stone to climb aboard the airplane. It's a stepping stone to Vaikuntha, death for him. It's just, and that invitation is the more important thing. Death is just the step to receive that invitation. That's all. And this is why when Srila Prabhupada in his final days, he was very sick and weak, the devotees would come see him and Prabhupada would see the pity in their eyes. Oh, Prabhupada is suffering so much. And Prabhupada would say, don't pity me. One day you will be in the same situation. Learn from this moment. Don't feel sorry. Because we do not know what is happening in the life of a in the moment of death for a devotee. From our perspective, we see and we think, oh, this person must be suffering so much. But what is happening from a devotee's perspective, we don't know, right? So this is a general point about suffering for a devotee, is that the physical suffering and the physical pain and the moment of death on the surface look very much the same. Devotees die of cancer, they die of heart disease, they die of car accidents, they die of natural old age, they die in Vrindavan, they die in the West, they die all over, everywhere, just like everyone else does. The mechanical process of death looks exactly the same. It's not that it will look any different. But what is happening on the inside, we do not know. How the devotee is receiving that moment. We are seeing the devotee gradually suffering and looking, oh, so painful. Every bone in their body must be aching. And the devotee is receiving the Vishnu Dutas. How do we know? In fact, we can see. We can see many times. There's one really nice example. This is not exactly about death, but it's similar. It's a case of terminal illness, of suffering. The story is told by Romapad Maharaj a few years ago, where there was this one disciple of Srila Prabhupada, the devotees had known, he had joined very early on, and somehow the devotees had lost contact with him. And he had lost contact with the devotees over time. So years had passed, and just recently, this is a few years ago, Romapad Maharaj and a few other god brothers decided, we need to go find this god brother of ours and see how he's doing. So they looked and looked and looked, and finally they found him in an old age home, in a nursing home, where he was being taken care of completely because he had a very advanced case of Alzheimer's, a brain degenerative disease. And so advanced was it that he could not remember his relatives and his family. He could not even remember his own name. It says, so on the surface is a very sorry condition. And what would one would think, why would Krishna put a devotee through this situation? Because he says, name bhakta pranashyati. And yet look at how he's suffering. So they went to this nursing home, they came to the front desk, to the reception, and they introduced themselves. And they said, are you family? And they said, no, we're not family. So who are you? Well, we are members of the same, this is in Boston, in the United States. We are members of the same religious institution as he is. We are Hare Krishnas. And the woman lit up and she said, really? You're the Hare Krishnas? Wow, thank you for coming. And they said, why? He said, well, you know, this person we have, he has this advanced case of Alzheimer's. He doesn't know anyone. He doesn't know his own name. He cannot engage. And at that point, you cannot do anything. You cannot even brush your own teeth, practically speaking. He said, but somehow or another, we don't understand. He insists that every evening in our common room, where all these other people are there, just like him, all these elderly people, he comes into the common room and he insists on leading everyone in singing this mantra. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare. And this is the only thing that gives him happiness throughout the whole day. And it makes everyone else so happy as well. Now, can you imagine a person who had lost the capacity to remember his own name, is now remembering the name of Krishna as the only thing that he remembers? Means, what is a devotee's prayer at the time of our death? What is our prayer? That let me only remember you. Yes? How does that verse go by Maharaj Kulashekara that Prabhupada loved to sing? Krishna tadiya padapankaja panjarantam. He's saying, please Krishna, let me die now. Because this, my body's healthy and I know I can remember you. My mind is still sharp. That's how he's praying. This is the prayer of every devotee. And look at the way Krishna had cared for this devotee. That Krishna, from an outside perspective, had destroyed him completely. And someone can look at him and pity him and say, poor thing, this is, look at how Krishna cares. But from a devotee's perspective, Krishna had gradually taken away everything from his mind, everything from his heart, wiped the slate clean. So it was impossible to think of anything. And the one thing he had left in his heart was Harinam. That was it. This is how Krishna fulfilled his promise to this devotee. Name bhakta pranashyati. My devotee never perishes. So this is what death means for a devotee. Of course it will be painful. Of course it might hurt. Yes. But for a devotee it's an invitation. And Krishna ensures that we will remember him at the time of his death. He makes sure. And therefore at the end of this chapter in Bhagavatam, Krishna does exactly the same thing he does at the end of chapter 8. In this chapter he says, this yogic siddhi, it's actually very funny this chapter. Because Krishna says, if you think of me like this, you can get this siddhi. If you think of me like this, you can enjoy with the apsaras in heaven. If you think of me like this, you can get anything you want. If you think of me like this, you can control the world. And hopefully, someone reading it will get the point. You have to think of Krishna, that's the point. Everything you want comes from thinking of Krishna. And so at the end of this chapter, he says, my devotees, they get everything. Swachandamrityu, whatever they want, they get. Because they're thinking of me. Right? Same thing at the end of chapter 8, Krishna says. If you leave in the dark, if you leave at the night, you leave in the day, doesn't matter. For a devotee, I take care of everything. Antakale chamameva. I take care of everything. So, an axe, a tool, or an invitation. The choice is up to us. How we want to receive it. This fearsome thing called death. And Prabhupada in the story of Dhruva Maharaj gives the beautiful example of the cat and the rat. Right? That for the cat, for the rat, the cat's jaws are death. The rat dies even before the cat kills the rat just by fear of the jaws. It has a heart attack and dies. But the same jaws, when they go around the neck of the kitten, she picks up the kitten like this, right? They are the most loving and comfortable place in this world. And so, we end with where we started. Hitopadesha says that in matters of religion, we should think that death already has its jaws around our neck. Such a frightening thought. Right? That's how we began. But from the perspective of a devotee, those are the jaws of the mother cat. Those are the jaws, that's Krishna's hands inviting us to come back home. So what is there to fear? Our time is up. It's 9:15, so I must stop at this point. If anyone has any questions or comments, we'll take just 2 minutes and we can answer any thoughts. Yes, Prue.
Thank you for the very devotional class, Prabhuji. I'm sorry, I'm going to ask a little bit of a technical question. In the story of Dhruva Maharaj, that it is said that death personified comes. So when I was reading it, I was just wondering that who exactly is this death personified? Mm-hmm. Can you throw some light on that?
Yeah, so death personified is talked about many times in Bhagavatam. Sometimes also you find with the prayers of Queen Kunti, she says, Bhi Bhayam, the Lord is feared by fear itself. So fear personified, death personified. Also in, I forget now, in other accounts also, I think in the story of King Prachina, the metaphor of Prachina Parishad, also death is there as a person. So in other religions of the world, also death is personified in a specific way. So as far as I understand, this is not a particular deva of any kind, right? The basic principle in the Vedic or the Bhagavad culture is that everything in this world is essentially a person. There is a personality behind everything. The trees, the rocks, even a dead entity has a personality behind it, which is controlling that principle of nature, right? That aspect. And so there's some personality clearly who's simply known by the activity itself, right? So Agni is known as the Agni is fire, but the demigod of Agni is known merely as Agni. Vayu is wind, but the demigod of wind is simply known also as Vayu. So there's nothing more to be said. So death is there, but whoever is the personality behind death is also just known as Mrityu or Antaka, and sometimes he can take physical form. As far as I understand, now this is speculation on my part, but it was not a Yamaduta, because Yamadutas, the Vaishnava never has to see the face of the Yamadutas, right? And it's not Yamaraj, because he's not Mrityu, he's Dharmaraj. He's the one directing the course of Mrityu. So this is a personality who basically is the personality behind the experience of death, right? Just like in everything in this world, there's some personality behind it that's there. So that may be there, but I think that the philosophical principle is more important, that stepping on the head of death means, philosophically speaking, that the devotee is willing to accept death. That we find that a devotee does not actually demand that he be spared the experience of death. This is also something we learn from Dhruva Maharaj's story. That sometimes, you know, like in the case of this Mahabharata, Trishanku was there. So he wanted to be spared the experience of death. In my self-same body, let me go to heaven. Let me go to Swarga. So I want to skip the experience of death. So this is also Hiranyakashipu's mode, or Ravana's mode. Let me build a staircase to heaven. You can go. You die and then you go. But he wanted to be spared the experience of death. So this is the Rakshasi Pravritti, that let me not experience death. A devotee is humble enough that he thinks, why should I be spared this experience? A devotee does not actually ask for that. Let it come. Yad bhavyam tad bhavatu bhagavan. Purva karmanurup. Death is the natural order of things. I will accept it. And that's what we learn from Dhruva Maharaj's story, is that he's willing to take it. He doesn't deny it. We see with all the great Vaishnavas, they say, okay, we'll accept what is to come. Okay. Yes. Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhu. Very wonderful class you have given us. You said in Kaya View, the monks, they meditate in front of a skull, that in the monastery in Russia, you went there, you were talking about. So they were doing meditation to remember death. So generally we in material world, we do job, schedules, deadlines, so many things are there. So how we should remember death?
Yes. Yes, a wonderful question. You know, I think from going into those underground caves, I had a little bit, I mean, this is again my personal opinion, but it was a powerful way to meditate, but it's frankly seemed a little tamasic to me. Going in a dark place, looking at the skulls, you know, that kind of thing. For Vaishnavas, we don't have to meditate like that. The best meditation on death is study of Srimad Bhagavatam. You know why? Because the entire Srimad Bhagavatam is basically written to answer this one question. What is the duty of a person who is about to die? And it's all centered around this point I was making earlier, that all of philosophy and culture in this world is driven by the reality of death. So we see that Srimad Bhagavatam also is born simply because a devotee is cursed to die in 7 days. And Parikshit Maharaj is the best example of someone who takes it not as an axe and not as a tool, but as an invitation. Yes, he sees, oh, Krishna is calling me. Let me go first. Let me go ahead and prepare. Why should I wait now? Let me go. Why should I wait until I get pushed? Let me go and receive Krishna. He's coming to take me. So the best meditation on death is Srimad Bhagavatam. If we study Srimad Bhagavatam on a regular basis, you see Bhagavatam speaks about death again and again and again. Practically every story of Srimad Bhagavatam is the story of a great devotee preparing for death. Sooner or later. The kings, they give up their kingdom, they go to the forest. The great yogis, they sit in meditation and go back to Godhead. One after another, the story of Sati, the story of, you know, they're all stories of preparation for death. So study of Bhagavatam is sufficient. Yes.
Hare Krishna. You said usually the devotees or any sane person would not contemplate committing suicide. But in one exceptional case, we see Chhota Haridas committing suicide and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu approving of that. And then he attains perfection also. Would like to explain that particular case?
Yes. So Chhota Haridas's case is very unique in so many different ways. It's a very tough case actually, because it displays a side of the Lord. Normally Mahaprabhu is very forgiving, very kind, but in this case he's very hard. Normally suicide is considered to be a terrible thing to do, but in this case the Lord approves and he still attains perfection. Normally in Kali Yuga, if we have some random negative thought, it's not held against us. But in this case, it is. Chhota Haridas is that multifaceted exception which proves all the various rules in our practice of bhakti. Basically, we see even in the case of Chhota Haridas, even though the Lord in some unusual way, indirect way, approves, but he still has to go through the experience of being the ghost, right? Of being the Brahman ghost, still, because you cannot avoid that fate. I think it's very risky to make Chota Haridas an example for any of the devotees, because if we enter the body of a ghost and take that form, what guarantee is there that we will receive the mercy of any Vaishnav or of Mahaprabhu? In that disembodied form, it is very difficult to be the recipient of mercy. Better we follow the example of Sanatan Goswami, who on one occasion, maybe two occasions, right, he tried to commit suicide. And Mahaprabhu on both occasions chastised him. He said, "How dare you decide to do something like this? Your body belongs to me. Your body is my property, and you have no right to give it up without my consent." This actually raises something very subtle about the nature of death. You see, throughout the history of our Vedic culture, you see that this idea of treating death as an invitation or as a tool of embracing death is something that's very powerfully embedded. You look at the Jains, for example, they have this Sallekhan practice, right? Where you gradually, when the time is clear and you get permission from all your Gurujan, then, and you know time is departure is there, gradually you fast to give up this body. We find many examples of this in our Vedic heritage also and in the Shastras of people who, when the time is there, they fast and they gradually give up. If the Lord has given you the privilege of knowing that death is coming, Srila Prabhupada also gradually gave up eating and drinking and so on as a way to prepare for the final moment. There's a very subtle but very important difference between welcoming death when it is inevitable, preparing for it, and committing suicide. These two things sometimes look similar, but they have to be clearly distinguished. In one case, the Lord has made the decision, your time is up. And every person who is about to die a natural death is given that sense. Right? You know when that time has come. And okay, now give up everything. Enjoyment of all the senses, eating, drinking, and like a yogi, take this prana within, up to the Brahmarandra and out. Right? This is one thing. The Lord has decided the time of departure. And on the other hand, forcing that moment ourselves, that's suicide. Right? So these two things should have to be clearly distinguished. One is welcoming death and the other is forcing it. One is controlling the process, which we have no right to do, and the other is accepting the process when it comes. So I don't want to keep everyone too long from our services and other duties. I know the time of completion is 9:15 and we've passed this already. So once again, I want to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart for your hospitality and for your association. Thank you all so much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.